Michael, thank you very much indeed for the introduction. At the weekend, a lady told me when she sat her final examination at Oxford in philosophy, expecting a long examination paper, all she saw was, "Is this a question?" And people agonized as to what to say. Some wrote extensively, but after 20 minutes, she wrote very simply, "Is this an answer?" And actually got a first-class honours degree. Now, I feel a bit like this in looking at your question. But let me make a confession to start with, and I make it in the presence of David Hannay, who's been my mentor for so long. I've been a multilateralist for most of my career. And why? Because in today's world, no country can isolate itself from what's happening. If you believe what the Prime Minister says about the causes of the present problem, they all emanated from the United States. Well, maybe a slight exaggeration, but the fact is the present financial crisis is not capable of resolution in one member state. If you look at what happened in China some years ago with SARS, 2 weeks later people were dying of that disease in Toronto. Climate change, classically an issue which does not respect any national border. I was sent to Brussels in 1982, among other things, to argue that the European Union should have no competence in education, environment, or energy policy. And we know today that even in education, there's a scope for the EU to do things. But certainly, environment and the whole question of energy supply and how you handle energy, basically, it's got to be done outside the nation state. Terrorism, the same. Collective defense, the health and prosperity of nations, international trade policy, our prosperity, are all tied up in something greater than the nation state. And finding solutions requires states to work together, yes, to promote and understand their national interests, but at the same time to reach accommodation with others. Compromise in that sense is not a dirty word, but it's a necessary element in reaching an agreement. That's no different to commercial life, where if you're going to get a deal, the parties to the deal must all see a benefit within it. So the challenge for the multilateralist is to put yourself in the footsteps, the shoes of the people with whom you're negotiating. Try to understand, and then try and deliver outcomes which match what you want nationally. And of course, for the United Kingdom, NATO, the European Union, UN, are basic elements for us in terms of international policy. As Churchill once said, there's only one thing really worse than negotiating with your allies, and that's having no allies with whom to negotiate. So against that, how does the UN measure up? Well, it's hardly an aspect of normal international activity in the economics sphere which isn't one way or the other influenced or regulated by bodies associated with the UN. The IFIs, IATA, IMO, the World Trade Organization, even our postal services. Today there are 100,000 UN peacekeepers deployed around this world in some 20 countries. The World Food Programme is in at least 75 countries. And that's not just delivering food, it's actually coping with the production of, encouraging, dealing with nutrition, the whole range of aspects associated with. Coping with natural man-made disasters, 22 million refugees today. UNICEF, the World Health Organization, UNDP. For me, in a nutshell, those bodies justify the continued existence of the United Nations. And bear in mind, the UN doesn't do harm. It aims to do good. And it confronts, as it does that, a raft of challenges out there. There may be fewer conflicts today, and most of those are intra-state, yet probably mostly unremarked in London. 3 million people have died in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. since 2000. You look at development and the essential link between development, security, and human rights. They're essential to the nature of any state. Dealing with the first of those, development, the Millennium Development Goals, the targets recognized within the UN to cope with hunger, disease, to improve education, especially for girls, to combat disease. This year, 500,000 women will die of avoidable deaths associated with childbirth. 2.9 million will die of HIV/AIDS. A shocking statistic, 500,000 kids are likely to die, of whom half will probably die of measles, an avoidable disease. And there are 1.6 million people in this world living without adequate sanitation or water. 1 billion who live on less than $1 a day. Now the targets are clear, what we've all signed up to by 2015, but they're slipping, they have been slipping, and the situation is getting worse, as the UN Secretary General has reminded us in the last week. That means the developed countries have to meet their commitments, yes, and the recipients accept their obligations too, in particular to put in place programs to implement on their territories the Millennium Development Goals. Look at climate change. When I was living in the States, the argument was still not won as to whether there was a phenomenon called climate change. Well, a stark reality is that it's happening, that global warming is a threat to us all, and that whatever we do now, we inherit the legacy of the last century of economic activity, and that we require all of us an agreed approach which tackles on a binding basis a cap on CO2 and other emissions, tackles the root causes of deforestation, which contributes something of the order of 18% of the problem that we have, and where there's a very simple double whammy. But if you chop down trees, there are fewer leaves to actually photosynthesize carbon dioxide and create oxygen, and at the same time, every time you burn a tree, you send up a huge mass of carbon dioxide. The increased access and development of clean technologies, the financing of those, essential. And as Nick Stern demonstrated, the cost of doing nothing is much greater than the cost of taking the necessary action. And the solution there, well, there are many, many contributions to it, but the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change is quite essential as one of the key elements. How do we cope with counter-terrorism? And I'm not now going to claim that the United Nations has a huge role, but in terms of the Security Council's contributions and the three committees that it has working on this subject, make discreet and positive contributions. The essence being, of course, that counter-terrorism and effective policy is the sum of actions which can be taken by all member states, all organizations, all multilateral organizations who can contribute to tackling that problem. They all have to contribute. But against that basis, where are we in the UN? Well, it can also and should address those issues which are used as a false justification for terrorism, notably the Middle East peace process. But if we look at the conflict theatres, Darfur, Ethiopia, Eritrea, where not only is the UN engaged on the ground, but actually needs to tackle the triggers of conflict which are there and which exacerbate the situation. In this world, there's far too little attention given to the prevention of conflict. Not enough after the event to try and put in peacekeepers to maintain a peace, but tackling the spectrum of conflict from the potential to the actual and then stopping it breaking out again, quite crucial. I mentioned disease, but simply to note that the whole series of HIV, AIDS, TB, malaria, which day by day tens of thousands of people are dying from them, and where sensible action can help. When I mentioned measles came pretty close to eradication in about 2004, and then because of stupid decisions and the inability and unwillingness to vaccinate in one member state in Africa, net result is that it's broken out again in Africa. But a very, very nasty disease, especially for the poor and for the weak. Now, too often, let me stress, the United Nations is blamed for action it failed to take when the problem rests with member states who are unwilling to act. Think back to Rwanda or Sarajevo or other cases. It's the failure of nations. And that's where the UN is very much like a mirror. What you see is what you get. It reflects the political will of sovereign states. And there is an inherent tension. It's the tension set out in the Charter between the provision which says thou shalt not interfere in the domestic affairs of a sovereign state, and yet more and more issues out there. If you believe in rights, if you want to tackle poverty, if you want to ensure political and sustained economic secure development, somebody does need actually to intervene. Look at the Myanmars, the Zimbabwes, the North Koreas, the development of nuclear energy and what pertains to it in some countries and which is a potential threat to the rest of us. So in addressing those challenges, what does today's UN need? Well, it certainly needs a great deal of internal reform. The Secretary General should have power to act and should not be fettered by the member states. It needs to develop and accept the sense of prioritization, be far more cost effective, and actually look at the outputs it delivers. Because the delivery of the UN is how you judge on the ground how effectively it does. In Addis Ababa today, there are probably 23 UN agencies on the ground. If you're the Ethiopian government, you can be forgiven for not actually understanding to whom should you relate on which aspect. I'm all in favor of competitive discussion between agencies, but when it's a destructive competition which doesn't help and confuses and above all doesn't deliver, then it needs a remedy. But we also need the right policies in order to be able to tackle the challenges, some of which I've tried to set out. And with that goes, of course, the question of institutional change. Is the UN, as it's presently configured with its members, does the Security Council do the job? Does the General Assembly do its? I'm quite clear that the Security Council is more efficient than most of the other organs, but that's not to say that it is today representative of the modern United Nations and its 192 states. Now, Michael, you mentioned that we occasionally had in these meetings generals. I'm just reminded that, as I'm speaking after lunch, the last time I did this in London, the serried ranks in the front of generals and admirals promptly went to sleep. And I turned to your equivalent in the chair at the time and I said, what are you going to do with them? Because their contribution is becoming quite voluble. And the chair said, well, you put them to sleep, you wake them up. But as far as I can tell, everybody is more or less with me. Well, so what are the problems for the UN in trying to move forward and tackle some of those changes that are necessary? Partly the vested interests, the influences in New York. When Kofi Annan tried 3 years ago to introduce a measure of a career structure for people working for the UN, much needed, because the average contract outside is probably about 9 months. Kofi Annan was the subject of a vote of no confidence by the trade unions based in New York. I thought one of the worst things the trade unions could possibly have done. The distrust between G77 and the developed countries is as bad today as it's ever been. The lack of confidence in each other, the inability to work constructively together, the unwillingness to accept that other people have interests, to reflect those. The developed can properly be accused of not meeting their obligations, but at the same time, the developing don't always respect what they should be doing. And certainly when you have a vote in the General Assembly on the human rights situation in Sudan, and on a procedural vote, that resolution is thrown out by the General Assembly, a greater indictment of the GA and its inability to address problems in certain countries and certain types of issues becomes very, very obvious. But the truth is, the UN does many things well. There are many things it ought to do much better. Now, things that it doesn't do that it ought to do. But essentially, as we look forward at the challenges we confront, my simple contention is that the world more and more needs to address issues multilaterally, that the UN is the one body which gives full membership, legitimacy, and as necessary, a legal basis for action, and that as such, we need this UN, but it therefore has a future. But what we do have to make sure is that that future tackles the issues it ought, that the UN is the beacon for the oppressed, the hungry, and the poor, but at the same time is an organization prepared to change and adapt to those problems, and to do so 60-something years on in a way which reflects how we ought today to tackle these issues. But essentially, for this country, it matters a great deal, and the economic, political, strategic, and I venture the security interests of the United Kingdom are bound up with the United Nations continuing and making a better success of the challenges we face. If I may, Michael, I'll stop there and let's go to questions.